Hey, everybody, this is Bevan. Welcome to Bevan, a Femme Over 40 and Her Friends podcast. I'm your host, Bevan. I've said my name three times. It's time to start the show. Today's episode, I'm so excited to introduce you to my friend, Tristan. We met, I don't even think we talked about this in the episode, but we like met through friends like 13 or 14 years ago, a long time. And just a person who like really landed in my consciousness as a bright light in this world. And we got reconnected recently and just... I love Tristan's story. I love people who really pursue getting better over time and just allow 1% better every day. And I am blown away with Tristan has this very simple and beautiful formula for getting rid of insecurity in relationships. And I'm excited for you to hear it. And excited for you to hear our episode. I laughed so much. And one of my favorite parts about editing this podcast is listening to my conversations again and laughing. I usually laugh at the same parts and I forget that I laughed as much. It's the closest I have to having a twin is listening to things I've already done and laughing at the same time again. Before we get to the show, I want to tell you about the best way to support this podcast, which is through my Patreon page. Patreon is a website that allows creators like me to create work and a membership site for folks like you who want to support the work in the world. This podcast is entirely supported by my Patreon. So is my blog, queerfatfemme.com, and pretty much everything I do is supported by Patreon at this point in the coronavirus. I'm so grateful to my Patreon supporters for being there for me, with me, and doing the thing. And I'm super grateful to get to do this work. Part of the Patreon, my flagship tier is Fat Kid Dance Party aerobics online classes. Fat Kid Dance Party is an aerobics class I created for anybody who feels left behind by mainstream fitness. If you've ever been called too much, too fat, or felt too awkward to dance, this is the class for you. It's all levels. I've had people who have done Ironman, and I've had people who haven't done any movement for years enjoy and love my class and find benefit from it. As a teacher, I would say I draw a lot of inspiration from Richard Simmons and Miss Piggy, but of course in my own way. And I'll say, here's my special sauce. 80% of Fat Kid Dance Party is literally just mindset. So I'm really there teaching you mindset stuff about loving your body, freeing yourself, and tons of stuff to help you navigate the world a little bit easier, to reduce your anxiety, a lot of good stretching. There's always 6 classes available. A 10-minute, a 20-minute, a 45-minute, and 2 full 55 to 60-minute classes, plus a chair class. So all of that, 6 classes to choose from at a time. Every week I upload a new fresh video, and you can find all of that at Patreon, patreon.com/FKDP, which stands for Fat Kid Dance Party. Now, that's the $25 tier, but $5 a month gets you access to Bevan's Bites, which is an exclusive podcast just for my Patreon listeners. It has lots of Reiki healings, meditations, Q&A questions, advice, and then things I'm going through, updates that I only share there, ways that I've dealt with like when trauma and trigger comes up. And because I always find it really helpful when teachers of mine kind of walk me through their process of just living life. So that's all there. Plus, any level at my Patreon, any level of support, you get access to my weekly Zoom aerobics class. It's 11 a.m. Pacific on Saturdays. I was so resistant to teaching on Zoom. I thought it would be really hard, and it's actually been great. I love it. I love seeing people's smiling faces after class, and we do a little like 10-minute hangout and just introduce each other. So if you want to meet friends during this pandemic, if you want to just jiggle your body and enjoy that body that you have today, not the body you had 10 years ago, not the body you think you should have, but this body right now. And you can join that class even if you don't join Patreon. Tickets are $12, and you can find the link on my Instagram profile, which is Bevan's Party or Fat Kid Dance Party, both of those. But anyway, I just super appreciate you tuning into the podcast. I hope that you enjoy this conversation with Tristan and it leaves you feeling inspired to just get a little bit better in your life. Now, Tristan, welcome to the podcast. You can't
thank you for having me.
You just made the best face. I actually intentionally want this to be audio, but like I want you to know that Tristan makes great facial expressions.
I hate all pictures of me for this reason, because I'm so expressive that I always look like a demented Muppet, like in every freeze frame of me talking publicly. I can't help it. It's just what my face does.
I love the Muppets so much. Strongly identify as a Muppet, not a person. Like when I get my makeup done by a makeup artist, I say specifically, I want to look like Miss Piggy, and I'm not joking. So like, cause you got it in the big cheek, the like strong pink on the cheek, the strong eye, right? And like, and also I have a Muppet smile, but I don't think I look like a demented Muppet most of the time, but I love that you do.
I certainly do.
You need all the Tristan is joining me from Portland, Oregon, and is, what's your sign? I don't even know your astrology.
Really? That's how we're starting?
Yeah. Yeah, that's
how God. Strong. I'm a Libra.
Oh, great. That's actually perfect for the work you do.
Okay, next time someone asks me, I'm just going to lie and say I'm something else. And then they're going to be like, oh my God, that's actually perfect for the work you do. And then I'm going to be like, ha ha, just kidding. None of this is science. I'm a Libra. And then they're going to be like, oh, but that is also perfect for the work you do. And I'll be like, no, no.
Do you know your rising or your moon?
I don't know any of those things.
You don't? I'm shocked. How have you been queer for this long? And no one has sat you down and been like, Tristan, I need to do your birth chart.
They've tried. I just can't get into, I cannot get into the birth chart thing, especially since they've said that the way that the planetary alignment is, whatever we thought our signs were are no longer even our signs. Like, it's literally all made up. I'm so happy that it brings meaning to people's lives, but I've also seen it used as a weapon. And so I'm like, I do not know. I will not participate in this. This is shenanigans.
Okay. I want to just say, I too have seen that weaponized. I too have heard the thing, but I think it's BS. I think astrology is so old that it's like necessary. Like, it's just part of it, but it's fine. Here's the thing. Have you watched Battlestar Galactica?
No.
Okay. What a treat you have in store for you to watch this show. Because you love sci-fi. We were just talking about this before I started recording. So Battlestar Galactica, you're going to love it. And I believe it all. And it really, like, there's a moment in like season four where they really tie astrology into like the destiny of the universe. And of course that appealed to me, but I think you'll like the sci-fi and character development. And there is not an interdimensional gay orgy.
No, no, that's what Sense8 was good for. Uh-huh. Gay sex.
I'm so glad that
I don't know, the like horoscope thing, it feels, it's just another religion to me. It's just like more belief in the unknown. And that, again, it's so great. I'm so glad if it gives people meaning. But then it is also like, just as I don't want a Christian being like, what? You don't believe in the Bible? I'm like, yes, because it's all fucking made up. Like, it's all made up. It's made up by humans whenever, it doesn't matter. Mm-hmm. It's just not for me.
That's great. I'm glad that it's not for you, and yet also still understand you as a Libra.
Of course you do. Sure. Sure. JK, I'm a Sagittarius. Ah, sucker. No, I'm a Libra. No, I wouldn't trick you like that.
Thank you. Thank you for coming to my podcast with your true, honest opinions.
If there was somebody that I hated, that's what I would do to them.
Oh, yeah. If you hate someone, tell them you're a Pisces.
Okay.
I'm just kidding. That was just a dig at all Pisces.
Again, means nothing to me because I don't believe in it because it's not science.
So we won't go down the astrology path, but I do. There's a lot of astrology babes who listen to my podcast, so I think they like to know.
That is great.
I also like to know. I like to understand my friends more, so I like to use it. It's funny that you say it's not science because I feel like a lot of astrologers treat it as science and like dig into like the star charts because it's all math. You know, anyway.
Totally. The stars are definitely science. But the way that the stars were lined up the moment you happened to emerge into the planet, that's the thing that I just don't get is just like, then how? How is like your personality determined by the alignment of the stars when you're born? Like that's the piece. I'm not saying it's not real, but I also don't tell people that the Bible's not real or Jesus isn't real. That's not for me to say. Yeah. But just like, tell me how it is then.
Yeah.
Because I don't understand.
Do you want to know what I believe and like how that lands for me?
Sure.
Okay. So for me, I think that like, I believe we're all kind of here for a purpose. We all have seeds of greatness inside us and like that we're all kind of unique expressions of God and that our God, I believe that God is like the consciousness that links everyone together. And so the way the stars align that maps out our personality and our conflicts and the things we're going to go through as a human, like that's all ordained. So I think like no human life is an accident. I think that every human life is precious and valuable. And we're all kind of here as puzzle pieces. I think truly human ingenuity has the problem, has the ability to solve all the problems we face as a society. And we have to unlock each other.
But then how does the where the stars are in the sky have any connection? I'm saying that all sounds great.
Yeah. But the how, I think the how is just in, it's like the tradition and the research around like what that does and how that maps out. Cause like there are certain like houses, like where the stars are that like line up with different characteristics and personalities and challenges that you're going to have in a lifetime. So like, I'm going to say that that comes from like tradition and reverse engineering and maybe people thinking of it a really long time ago and like refining. I don't know. It's fine.
Okay.
I see your shifty eyes. I get it. I get that. And I'm not trying to win you over. I'm just trying to explain the how and why I believe what I believe. Yes. What do you believe, Tristan?
I don't know. I really don't. Yeah. And I go through phases. And, you know, there are times in my life when I felt incredibly connected to the divine, to the unknowable, to the mystery. And then there are other times when I've just been like, no, it's just all completely random. Mm. You know, and so it's really about, did I have a friend that died that year? You know, because sometimes when you lose someone, you're like, oh, that was meaningless. Like, there's no God. Like, who would have ever, there's no plan. Who would have ever, how, what could possibly account for the two best people I've ever known in my life dying of cancer before I'm 35, before they're 50?
Yeah.
Like, there's no, no. But then there are other times when, you know, I'm able to spend time outdoors, when I'm able to go to concerts, when I'm able to be like deep in a meditation practice, when I'm able to sort of tap into something that feels like, oh, there's something floating above that sometimes I have access to and sometimes I don't. But then, you know, witchy white people do their thing. And then I'm like, oh God, no, I'm nothing. Like I'm nothing. Like it's just what I can see. So it's about, you know, it's about ways in which things have been traumatizing to me and wielded against me. Mm-hmm. It's about my own connection to things and other people. And so, yeah, it's, I don't know, it's complicated.
That's beautiful. And it's kind of funny because like, for me, the opposite, I had a lot of friends die before I was 35. And the way I made space and meaning for that was through spirituality. That's actually how I really developed into my spirituality. Because like, the why doesn't make any sense, right? Like, why someone who is just so profound and really using their life for good and to impact the world, and they get to keep living. And no offense to my father, but he's, you know, 71, not doing a lot and not really taking care of his precious life or his health or his body temple, right? Like, why is that fair? Like, why is that like that? And so for me, like surrendering that to something greater and like bigger, and sometimes people just make a profound impact on the world in a short time, you know, and like, I don't know. It doesn't, it's, I think both and, right? Like, and it also, I'm going to say it tracks as a Libra that you've changed your mind about what you believe.
Right now. Sure. Sure.
Thanks for letting me have fun with that.
No problem.
Kristen, will you tell me, give me like, Without this being too LinkedIn, will you give me your like elevator pitch of like what you do right now in this incarnation? I know you just left a job and now you're like full-time consulting and coaching, and just tell me what you do, who you help.
Yeah. I mean, if you want to lean into the, I'm like, one of my areas that I feel like I'm strong in is actually my ability to code switch. And so I think if you're going to lean in to the astrology piece, owning my Libra-ness, I feel that my calling on the planet is to bring balance. For a long time, most of my life, my belief has been that too few people have too much power. And so my life has really been dedicated to wrenching power from those hands and more evenly distributing them amongst the people.
Oh, that's amazing. How is that work sort of showing up in your life today?
Oh my God. you know, sometimes you feel like, you look back on your life and you're like, why did I do that? Like, why did I fall into that thing? And then it comes back full circle and you're like, that's why. And that's just where I am right now in my life. Just all the random things that I have managed to gain some knowledge in now is what seems to be needed. And so, you know, a good chunk of my work right now is working with other white folks on anti-racism. You know, when the revolution started and people were in the streets and I was in the streets too, and also trying to own that, you know, I'm a dad, I have three kids, and now we have a trans youth foster kid who's staying with us who's 16. So we have four people under 18 in my house. And I didn't know that me being in the street was the most effective thing for me to be doing right now. I didn't feel safe. And like, knowing what I know, having the expertise I have, like, is that the work that I'm most called to do? And so just as part of my allyship, I offered to do anti-racism coaching with white people. I'm trained in that. Like, I like have a fancy certificate in anti-racism coaching facilitation, blah, blah, blah. I'm not big on accreditation, you know, or credentials, but I did that, and I've invested in that practice in four different anti-racism methodologies, schools of thought, sort of training programs, because I like to weave in a bunch of different ways of doing things and make something new. And so that was my allyship work initially, was I said, okay, I will do like 10 white people who just want to spend an hour getting some tools, spilling their guts, like being their messy, gross white people selves to like sort of exercise those demons. That's what I'll do. And then those 10 slots, I think, filled up in 14 minutes. And I was like, oh, okay, well then I'll open up another 10 for July, you know, and those filled up and people were like, well, can we pay you to do this? And because I was in the process of quitting my job and opening my consulting firm, I thought, well, I have conflicting feelings about as a white person taking money, doing anti-racism work. And so just trying to find that balance of honoring my expertise as someone who's invested in this, trying to combat those voices that tell me as a trans person, I'm not worth anything and I should do all of my work for free if I really love the world.
Oh God.
And so, I finally like settled on a sliding scale. And so that's some of the work that I'm doing right now is working with white folks on anti-racism stuff and then doing a lot of system stuff, a lot of trainings, workshops, most of that work that I do from the systems level is around queer and trans inclusion. Workshops, coaching, systems change. Yeah.
Yeah. Oh my God. That's amazing. So for systems change, like what types of organizations do you work with? Who's your like ideal clients? Like who should reach out to you for that kind of work in an organizational level?
Yeah. I mean, just because I'm a trans man who had a baby and my dad's a doctor. So like, I'm a nerd. I love medicine. I love bodies. I love science as we've already established. And similarly, I love the science of building like radically welcoming spaces. And so I really love working with medical providers, practitioners, complementary medicine, acupuncture, naturopaths. I've done a lot of work in fertility spaces, fertility clinics, birth workers, blah, blah, blah. I just launched a digital training on trans pregnancy for birth workers, mm-hmm. which I've been doing in person for years. And then I finally moved it online. The pandemic forced me to. So yeah.
I love that you say the pandemic forced you to, but really, like, what a gift to the world to, like, create that, to have refined it, right? Like, because that's someone who teaches something that's a very living organism, right? My aerobics class is different every time. It was so hard to pin it down to, like, the workout videos, and it's very 2018. You know what I mean? Like, I see it, and I'm like, that's how I taught it that then, but it's different now. But, yes, it is hard to, like, commit it to, like, a webinar or whatever. But then it's available, right? So many people...
It is. It's more available, and it can continue to be a living, breathing organism. You know, I built it so that it's hosted on a platform where it's not like a 3-hour Zoom call of me doing my normal training. Mm-hmm. No, it's a bunch of different videos, a bunch of different modules. I was able to bring in four other trans and non-binary folks who've given birth. to really honor that I'm not, I can only tell my story, you know, but here are four other ones. Here's like a home birth off the grid in Canada. Here's a Black trans man who gave birth in Brooklyn. Here's a trans guy in Houston who had a traumatic birth. Here's a non-binary person who did reciprocal IVF and carried their partner's baby. You know, there's just like, there's such a richness there that I can offer in this type of a setting. And then I can do like quizzes, downloadable PDFs, all these other tools. Like, we talk a lot about cultivating humility. What does that actually mean? Like, how do we get out of defensiveness? How do we get out of fragility for non-trans people? So that when a trans person says, I don't like what you did, you can be like, oh my God, thank you so much. And I'm so sorry. And I'll fix it. You know? So all these tools that I've created, I get to just put them all in there, which I could never do like in a typical 3-hour training. So I know it has been a gift. I just don't want to be one of those, you know, those like positive vibes only people who are like, well, the universe has given us the pandemic as an opportunity to walk through the portal of enlightenment or whatever. And I'm like, okay, Karen, but people are dying. You know, so I try to hold both, that it is really complicated and hard. And if we look for it, there are ways that we can use this really difficult situation to catapult us into a new way of being. But, you know, I just hate those people on Instagram.
I try really hard to actually be a person who is very positive, because like I need it. Like, cause I can go, when I go dark, I can go real dark, Tristan. And like, I don't like that part of myself. It's really miserable. It's so much suffering. And so like, I try to see the opportunities, but I also try to be a very balanced, realistic person on Instagram. But I also think like, you know, if anything this pandemic has done for us, it's shown corporations that they can provide access to work for people who can't commute. You know what I mean? Like, this is a real, like, we could have been more accommodating this whole time. And here's how this forced you into a level of accommodation that enables more people to get work, even as many people don't have work right now.
I think that's a totally realistic example of something that may come out of this that's good. Yeah. You know, my dearest friend is like, this is going to be the fall of capitalism. And I was like, listen, capitalism has survived way worse than a pandemic. People are like, well, now these idiot libertarians will be like, oh, we actually do need a government to take care of us in a crisis. And I'm like, no, they definitely are still going to believe that corporations will do what's right for us. So, but I don't know. I used to be much more optimistic, and I still think of myself as positive. It's just when you're so open and positive, like, life just really gets you.
I mean, I don't think being positive means life's going to get you. Life's getting you no matter what. Like, life will life at you.
No, I disagree, because, okay, so I operate like I am a 0 sometimes, I'm a 10 sometimes. My partner is like a 4 to a 6, like, okay, always. Like, doesn't get too upset or too excited. Yeah. What that means is when hard stuff happens, my partner is like almost completely unaffected by those things. Why? Because they didn't invest in those things to begin with.
Yeah.
They didn't have like so much openness to how wonderful and how terrible things can be. When you are that open, things do sink in, I think, at a deeper level. And in some ways, I'm super jealous of people who do operate at that more limited scope. But also, my superpower is having access to that full range.
Yeah.
It just means I mean, almost 40, and I still haven't developed successfully the boundaries and borders that I need to like let good stuff in, but like not also let bad stuff in.
Yeah. I mean, you know what I think? I think your partner is so wise, and like, that's a level of emotional maturity to be like, to really just find the joy. See, for me, it's like, I like to stay between a 4 and a 6. That's something I learned in Al-Anon. It's like really helpful, actually. Cause like, you never get like too excited. I mean, I get excited, you know, and I find joy in like looking forward to a banana after my forest walk, right? Like something really ordinary, but I find joy in it. And so I feel like I can be really positive and also stay like emotionally mature, like not let things like knock me off my rocker, I guess. I don't know. But I'm curious, like, for you as like, I want to dive back in. I want to hear like your kind of life story. Like, how did you get where you were? Like, when you were growing up, were you always different? Was it agonizing to be like in your body? And like, what was it like? When did you come out? Like, give me the kind of backstory.
Well, I'm Canadian by birth. So I have like typical Canadian, like they're liberal, but it's mostly they're just not so invested in other people. That's just the sort of the Canadian ethos, you know, like it that's what's so weird to Canadians about Americans is just like, we're just so much. Canadians are religious, but like only a little bit, you know, they're liberal, but like only a little bit. It's just not, they're conservative, but only a little bit. And that's, you know, my parents are pretty much in that, oh, they've radicalized as they've gotten older for sure. They're way more liberal now than they were when I was a kid, but you know, just like very reasonable, moderate, thoughtful, academic-y sort of intellectual people. But we moved when I was very little to a very conservative part of Southern California in the middle of the Mojave Desert. And so, yeah, I was raised in a really like liberal supportive household in a, like that was inside of a really conservative small town. It's like an outlet mall town. You know what I mean?
Oh yeah. Is it, how close is it to Palm Springs in the Coachella Valley?
Oh no, totally opposite direction. Not totally opposite directions, but if you're going to drive from LA to Las Vegas,
okay,
you'll drive through Palmdale is where I'm from. Palmdale. So the okay. Antelope Valley, yeah. Or if you drive from LA to like Bakersfield.
Uh-huh.
I don't know why you'd do that, but if you were going to, you drive through Lancaster.
Got
so
it.
Yeah, it's right next to an Air Force base, very military, very conservative, quite racially diverse, but still very conservative. No analysis around race, racism, difference. I wasn't.
My parents leave Canada?
I've asked them that so many times. My mom is like, oh, I was tired of the rain. And I'm like, that is no reason to move to the middle of the desert. But also like, it's where they were able to immigrate to. They needed the type of doctor that my dad is in that area. Mm-hmm. It was super close to LA. So there were some amazing cultural things. Like I was super into theater as a kid, which will surprise no one. And so my mom could like drive me down to LA and I could do theater and see plays and do things like that. Mm-hmm. We could drive to Santa Barbara. It was like 3 hours and go to the beach.
Mm-hmm. My mom's family did exactly that. They moved from Canada to Southern California. And my grandmother says it was, I mean, I think grandmother wanted to live in Hollywood, but she didn't until later in her life. But she said, we didn't like the snow. So my mom is like 12 years old and just gets immigrated here in the back of the car. And like, here you are, Southern California. Welcome from Canada. Okay.
Right, right. and I was a very strange child, like a very strange child. Mostly around like the social justice shit. Like, even though I didn't really have great language, and I still have just so much shame and regret about sort of like my early awakenings and how messy they were on the people around me. But, you know, I became a vegetarian when I was 10 and was super into animal rights. And then in middle school, at the very end of my seventh grade year in our biology class, they were like, oh, now you have to dissect frogs. Like, they added it to the curriculum. And I was like, no, I'm not going to do that. And they're like, okay, well, then we're going to fail you. Like, mind you, I'm in seventh grade. Like, this isn't even high school. I was like, well, that doesn't seem right. I don't want to have to do something that I don't believe in. Like, I don't eat animals. I don't want to participate in an animal being killed for my education.
Yeah.
But the school stood their ground and they were like, no, we'll fail you. You have to do this. It's required. So then I reached out to PETA. This is like the early 90s. So then I reached out to PETA and they were like, oh, that's completely against the law. Here's a bunch of like materials to help you make your case. And like, if they don't listen, like we think that you should call the news. And so I called the news. And so I ended up on the news and I staged a walkout with other students. And we had like signs in front of the school and everything. And then finally the superintendent for the whole district came down to the school and was like, okay, fine. Like, we'll let you do something alternative to this. And my parents really stood with me, you know, from being a vegetarian. My mom was like, I think it's great that you're making a sacrifice for something that you believe in. Like, I'll cook vegetarian. That's a small adjustment. Again, that was in 1992. So that's pretty in the middle of the Mojave Desert. So they always did that. Same with the marches. You know, my mom was just sort of like, well, I'll help you make signs, like whatever you need to do. So even though they didn't totally understand it, I think that they were just, you know, they understood and were proud that I was willing to take a stand for something. And I think that instilled in me really early on that my voice mattered and could make a difference. And I think not everyone has those experiences early. Yeah, but I didn't, I mean, but the trans thing doesn't come until way later. I really didn't understand that I was trans until I was like 18, 19, 20.
Wow. How did that realization come? And did you come out like, as, you know, because some people before they transition or realize about their gender identity, they kind of come out as gay because like that's the option they saw or whatever, like it's part of their sexuality, which we know sexuality and gender are different, but.
Yeah. I mean, that whole like age 15 to 20 is just like super murky. Like I definitely knew I was queer. Like I knew I was queer from as early as I can remember. Like when I was 9 and like did my first play and I like met gay men and I was like, oh, that. But you couldn't be a gay man if you're a 9-year-old girl. Like what?
Yeah.
Doesn't make any damn sense. You know? But getting older and being in theater and then doing dance and you know, though that kind of a thing, I knew I was queer somehow. And when I was 15, I told my mom that I was bisexual. That I had kissed my friend Kelly at a party, and she was like, "Kelly is your least attractive friend."
Oh my god! That might be the best coming out story I've ever heard. And I've heard a lot. The critique of who you were kissing. I don't care about the bisexuality, but you need to raise your standards, Tristan.
Yes. And you know, honestly, like that's also just like quintessentially my mom. Like my mom is not, she's not so much now, but definitely when I was younger, like it's very judgmental, so yeah.
Okay. Okay. Keep going.
Yeah. I mean, and then I can remember thinking like something, you know, there's something here. And all my boyfriends in high school were gay. I wasn't actually attracted to girls. I just like wanted to pass into queerness.
Yep.
And I liked girls. It's not that I didn't like girls, but I just was not ever attracted to them. So like, even when I had girlfriends, it was like, I just wanted to like do fun stuff with them, not like making out.
Yeah, exactly. I want to just do a quick PSA for anybody listening to this. You don't need permission to be queer. Like if you feel queer in you, like just you get to be queer, right? Like there's no hall pass, there's no committee. There's quite a few gay cards I would revoke if I were given that power, and yet no one has bestowed that upon me. So this is my welcome mat to anyone who just, if you feel that spark of like, I don't understand what my sexuality is or where this is, you don't have to go kiss your least attractive friend in order to be queer.
Well, tell that to me at 15. You know, like we didn't have any language.
Nothing. We had no one in media. Nothing.
Yeah. Nope. We tried to start a GSA at our school, and our vice principal said no.
Not surprising from the state administration with that frog thing.
That's right. Yeah. But that vice principal was Mormon, and he is right now in prison for having a sexual relationship with a male student.
Wow. So he's like, no GSA because I got these kids on lock.
It's also like, it's obviously just anecdotal, but it backs up a lot of the evidence we have that it's self-hatred. Like yeah. That's where homophobia comes from, is like people have stuff that they're not able to express in a healthy, appropriate way, which obviously a grown man having a relationship with a teenager is not, it's 100% unhealthy all the time. Mm-hmm. And it's also possible that he was just closeted and gay and knew that with the power dynamic with a younger person, a teenager, not a child, a teenager, it might have been a way where he thought he could get what he wanted in a safer way than with an adult. Icky. But yeah, it wasn't until a few years after that it became a little bit more clear that it's actually some gender stuff going on. And it was just a slow realization. And I went by gender neutral pronouns for a while, and I had a transitional name, just as I tried to figure out my path. And even when I started transitioning, like taking testosterone, even then, like I wasn't totally sure that I was trans. I was like, I didn't know, like, is there a pass? You know, where's the door? I can't find it. Like, am I allowed in? Am I trans enough? Am I queer enough? And you know, again, that's so long ago. It's like the dark ages in trans years, basically.
Really?
Any gay trans men. So the fact that I liked men and wanted to be a man, like not even my queer friends understood that. Now, of course, it's different. But, and finally, just like a slightly older, now in retrospect, he's probably like 24, but he seemed like a grandpa to me at the time. But he was like, it's okay if you don't know and you can just try. And if you don't like it, then you can just stop. I was like, oh, okay. And he's like, because we live in a transphobic world, there may always be voices trying to tell you you're not this enough or that enough. And all you can do is to just try and see if it works. And if it does, great. And if not, that's okay too. You didn't fail. It's just more information.
Yeah.
So I started transitioning and...
How old were you when you took hormones?
I think I started 18, 19, 20. So but I was taking right them around. On the...
Oh, I was just trying to contextualize this with that conversation. So was this like kind of predating you starting hormones or just like...
Yes. No, this is before. This is before I started taking hormones. Yeah. Mm-hmm. I was like, I think I want to start testosterone, but I'm not sure. And he was like, yeah, dude, like so many of us are not sure. That's okay.
Yeah.
Some people for sure are born and are like, I'm a dude. And then they have like their earliest memories, but like not everyone. And that's okay too.
Yeah, totally. And that's, it's all okay. And what's interesting when you say like, you're not feeling trans enough or like all that enough, it's not just for oppressed people. Like people, millionaires feel like they're not enough. Like people, some of the richest people in the world still feel a deficit in enoughness. And that's just from how we're coded around belonging. And when people say your belonging is conditional based on your behavior or your conformity, then that kind of quiets our actual human diversity, which is like within all of us. And like it, everybody has like things that make them different. And like white cisgender men with money, like who are like at the top of this pyramid, it's just like, it's so fragile when your power and your enoughness and your belonging is dependent on conditions and conformity, that like creates, you know, all this toxicity. And so it's so interesting how like, you know, we feel not enough and like that's kind of like a tool of the white hetero capitalist patriarchy, but then also they don't feel enough either, you know? And it's just like, it's the most common feeling that I think humans have that we don't talk about enough, is that people don't feel enough and they already are. So.
Yeah, I mean, honestly, like, that's a big part of what I work with white people on, is this idea that like, I'm not doing enough to fight racism. I'm not doing the right thing. I'm putting my energy in the wrong space. But then one person says I'm not doing enough and then I'm doing that. And then this is wrong. And then that's wrong. And you know, that's a huge thing, is, you know, one of the 10 tools that I work with, that I teach people, is resilience. And by that, I literally mean you get so strong and so secure in what your unique genius is and what your sphere of influence is. And you do all your work right there, where you can do the deepest work, the most effective work, have the biggest impact. And that way, when people come at you with that not enoughness shit, you're resilient against it. You can be like, I hear that you want me to be marching in the streets, but I have social anxiety. I can't do that. I'm immunocompromised. I can't do that. But I'm an artist and I can create art that continues to push the cultural conversation around Black lives and anti-Blackness and anti-racism and white supremacy. You get so clear in that none of that other noise even permeates.
Yeah. Oh, that's so great. Oh my God. It sounds great. It sounds easy. It's not easy. It's the hardest shit you'll ever do, is to learn how to be enough. And again, achieve that balance, right? Like that balance between like needing to refine and learn and get better, try, fail, try again, right? Try, fail, learn, try again, right? Can you tell me, so where did you go to college? And like, when you were transitioning, were you able to get medically prescribed hormones, or did you have to like, you know, go to the streets? Cause this was the 90s. So it was harder to transition back then.
Yeah, like 2000, 2001 is when I started taking hormones. And it's not that I couldn't get it from a doctor. I didn't think a doctor would believe me.
Yeah.
That I was trans. I was not like super macho. I wasn't, you know, super, I just wasn't any of the things that all the other trans people around me were. And I liked men and I didn't want to lie about that. you know? And so I was just really scared of the gatekeeping stuff. And so I did get hormones off the black market for several years. At the time, it just felt like I was buying it from friends. But then in retrospect, I'm like, that's the black market, Tristan. Yes. And so it wasn't until I got accepted into performing arts school that I like went to a doctor to do it the right way, because I wanted to transition, like actually transition, not testosterone whenever I could get it, under the tutelage of vocal instructors, because I was worried about my singing voice. And so I didn't go to college. I did a semester at Oregon State, and it was not for me. Mm-hmm. I actually didn't even graduate high school. I tested out of high school. I've never been good at school. I definitely had undiagnosed ADHD. And so there was a lot of stuff around attention, focus, discipline, mm-hmm. and what that had created in me over all the years of living with undiagnosed ADHD, was just a belief about myself that I was lazy, maybe I was smart. I knew I was smart, mm-hmm. but I was lazy. Like I couldn't work hard. I couldn't do it. Like I was just always going to fuck up. Yeah. And so, you know, I carried that into my adulthood, and I did a semester of college, couldn't hack it, dropped out, just lived in Portland for a few years, had a really, really horrific abusive partner mm-hmm. for a year and a half, really early on in my life, which really like impacted my own blueprint of myself. And I've been undoing that for the last 16 years.
I was going to say, what does healing from that look like for you? Because I know a lot of people who have that work to do.
It's so hard. You know, I work a lot with high schoolers and college students, you know, who are queer. And I always tell them, I know I'm not supposed to give you advice, but don't date people who are mean to you.
Yes, that's such good advice, actually. Don't date people who are mean to you.
Don't date people who are mean to you.
Yeah.
And now I created curriculum on like queer healthy relationships for queer young people, because I didn't know that shit.
Wait, that's a thing you do?
Yes.
Oh my God, that's so valuable.
I created it for Agnes Scott College, which is right outside of Atlanta. It's a historically women's college, but working to be more gender diverse. Mm-hmm. And you know, I did the thing that I always do, which is like, they said, will you come to our campus? And I was like, sure. And instead of just doing a keynote, why don't I also do three other workshops? Uh-oh. I like crashed my thing.
I just want to tell everyone who didn't get to watch that happen that like Tristan made a flamboyant arm gesture and then toppled the dry erase board.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Flamboyant arms. Okay.
Right.
My favorite.
Yeah, so I just said like, oh, and I'll do three workshops. And they're like, great, we'll take that package. And I was like, yay, now I have to create some workshops.
Yeah.
So I did. I just thought like, what do I wish I'd known at 19, 20, 21? And I was like, how to be in a fucking healthy relationship. How to say no.
Yeah.
How to figure out what I like and what I don't like, and how to be okay with people breaking up with me.
Oh my God.
And how to be honest about what I wanted and needed, and how to figure out what kind of relationship style I liked. So that's part of the healing for me, is trying to figure out like what tools do I wish I'd had, and then codify it and then use that to try and help other young queer people not get taken advantage of by really damaged folks who have not done their healing work.
Oh my God.
And being with really nice people helps after that.
Mm-hmm.
But not too nice. I was with a lot of people who were just too nice, and I was like, oh, I've overcorrected. You know, I've gone too far in the other direction, and this is just a boring person who's obsessed with me. I don't need that.
I like to call that beige, when the personality is just beige. It's not, for me, as a flamboyant human who might knock over a dry erase board before this conversation is over myself. It's just so hard to be with someone boring. Like, it's just, you need dynamic stuff, but you also need people who have growth and are interested in growing. And one of the most liberating things I ever heard as a young queer adult was from Dan Savage. And he said, and I know he's problematic, but like people say good things and bad things, but Dan Savage said this amazing thing. He's like, dating gay people is like dating Vietnam veterans. He's like, they're not like the regular population. They've been through more trauma than a typical person. So they're more likely to traumatize you
And like, that was just so freeing to like understand that, like that we're all just broken and kind of breaking each other when we date and like try to find connection and recreate all the chaos from our damaged upbringing. So
yeah.
And I'm sure that crosses sexuality too, but.
Oh yeah. Oh yeah. And to be honest, like being with my partner that I'm with now, it's like being with someone who is so on their shit.
Yeah.
That they don't allow you to re-traumatize them. They don't allow you to wield your hurt as a weapon against them. You know, there are so many examples I have from early on in our relationship where I tried to be like controlling, like, oh no, you can't be friends with that person because they're cuter than me.
You
and
said
that makes
that?
Me insecure. Oh, 100%, 100%. This is me 10 years ago. I'm like, whatever, 27, 28. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, yeah, you have a friend that I know wants to hook up with you who's way cuter than me. And I have had people in the past cheat on me. Yeah. And so I don't feel comfortable with you being friends with someone who I know has the hots for you. You know, and then my partner was sort of like, I'm so sorry that happened to you. And that's not my problem. And you don't get to control who I'm friends with. That sounds unhealthy to me. And so just having someone just like lay down the line, not to be like, oh my babe, I would never cheat on you at all. No, it was like, none of that matters. I'm not even going to go down that road with you because that road is stupid. And it's strengthening your own insecurity to continue to rely on me to tell you, I would never cheat on you. You know, it was just like, look, if you trust the commitment that we have with each other, then I get to hang out with hot people. I get to hang out with hot people that have the hots for me. And if there's anything I've done to make you feel like I'm not trustworthy, then that's the conversation we have. Mm. But if not, then I'm gonna go have lunch with my friend and you can call your therapist. But so many instances like that. And truly having someone that didn't buy into my shit, deeply healing. Because then it allowed me to do the work that I needed to do, to not continue to rely on someone to reassure me, but to get to the place where I'm like, oh, right. Okay. And then just being a good person. Like it sounds so basic, but I've just worked really hard on that. Like I just really work hard to be in my integrity and to be a great partner and to be honest and hardworking and loving and supportive. And that's how I hacked all my insecurities. You know, I just thought like at any point my partner's going to wake up and be like, oh my God, who have I married? I could do way better than this. And at some point I realized like that insecurity may always be there. So instead of trying to stuff it down or make it go away, instead to just be like, what if when my partner wakes up and realizes they could do better, I am better. Like, what if I just think like, what would be the perfect person to be with this amazing human I've picked? Then like, I should just work to be that. That's not hard.
Yeah.
Yeah.
1% better every day is a very doable thing. And
totally.
Most people forget and don't give themselves credit for what is possible. If they just like get into growing and stick to growth. And also I cannot wait to use the line. I'm going to go have lunch with my friend and you're going to call your therapist.
But having someone to just say like, okay, so I'm so sorry that happened to you, but that's not my responsibility.
Yeah.
It's profound. Yeah. And then it did free me up to do the kind of work that I needed to do. And to be honest, I still hear that mean person that I lived with and was in love with. I still hear them in my head sometimes telling me that I ain't shit. Ugh. You know, that I'm not, that I will never amount to anything, that no one will ever listen to me. I mean, still. And I'm a grown-ass man.
Yeah, with 4 kids.
I've been on the moth, okay? That was a bucket list for me, and I was on the moth. Uh-huh. And still. And that stupid person tried to friend me on Facebook recently.
They will always try to come for you. I think I truly believe everyone's emotionally abusive exes will try to come for them during this quarantine because everyone's real vulnerable. Mine did first thing that like the March 15th, this quarantine happened March 17th. I heard from them and like, I'm just like, and I've heard from other emotionally abusive exes and I'm like, it's cool. Good luck to you. I don't need to talk to you.
When you're ready to message me and say,
yeah,
I'm so fucking sorry.
Exactly. If your message does not start with that,
No, when it is just a friend request, yeah. Never. No. And I had a partner that I was not nice to. Mm. Like 100%. And that also has stuck with me for years, for over a decade. And it was only very recently, maybe 3 months ago in therapy when I brought it up and I was like, hey, like I keep having dreams where I find him and say, sorry. Oh. I'm sorry, I was a dick. You did not deserve to be treated that way. I take full responsibility for that. And he was like, okay, well then why don't you just send him that message? And I was like, well, isn't that super self-serving? And he's like, I don't think so. You can just write someone and take accountability for what you did. Mm. I was like, oh. He's like, how would you feel if someone who'd been mean to you in the past did that? I was like, that would feel great. That would feel great to just be like, you didn't make that up. I was awful. Mm-hmm. I'm sorry. So yeah.
Did you do it?
Oh yeah, I did.
Did it feel like, did you feel the release? Did you stop having
immediately? Oh. Immediately.
So good.
I haven't even checked to see because it was a Facebook. Actually, this is even wilder, more wild. This is part of what the like where I do get a little bit into the witchy space. Mm-hmm. And where I am like, oh, there's something. Because I have not, this is a person, an ex of mine who is a straight man. We don't have any friends in common. He lives in Hawaii, right? We've nothing. And he has the most generic name you could ever, like as close to John Smith as you could imagine. Mm-hmm. So I've never been able to even find him on Facebook because I've like looked to be like, could I make this right? Like at some point over the years, every 6 months or so, I just try to find him. Nowhere. So generic. How could I ever do this? And then I had this conversation with therapist. My therapist is like, yeah, you need to let this go. And part of how you let it go, you know, the German word for guilt is the same as the German word for debt.
Oh.
And so I was like, oh, that's right. I owe him a debt and I need to make it. I need to make it right. Mm. And the next day, so I make this commitment in therapy. I'm like, right, I'm going to write to him. I'm going to find a way to get hold. The next day, I go to a craft store with my kids and I run into the one person that I know who also knows him. And I have not seen this person in at least 12 years.
Wow.
The next day. And it happened. I'm in the craft store with my kids. I never go here. I'm never in this part of town. I look over, I see him and I'm like, there it is. There's the opening. Yeah. And what really was like just me putting out the good stuff of like, I want to find healing and I want to give someone else an opportunity to heal if there's a wound there. Mm-hmm. It is like literally the channels opened and there it was. And I saw him across the street. I was like, there he is. And I went over and he's like, oh my God, Tristan, you're so good. We caught up. And then when it felt appropriate, I was like, by the way, are you still connected to our mutual friend, my ex? Mm-hmm. And he was like, oh yeah, we're still friends on Facebook. He was in Hawaii. He got married. Now he's in Bend. And I was like, oh my God, that sounds so amazing. You know, I wonder if you think he might be open to me sending him a message to just let him know that I'm really sorry for the way that our relationship ended and that, you know, I really want to take accountability for not being a good partner. And he was like, you know, he's never told me how things ended. He never says anything bad about you, but I'm sure he would love that. Just, you know, find him on my Facebook. And we friended each other. And like literally within 24 hours, I was able to send that email, that message that I had been composing in my head for a decade, over a decade.
Wow.
That fast. And that's, you know, so that's part of the rise and fall of the like belief system and spirituality and stuff. Cause I've been having dreams where I see him and I apologize for so long. And I even have lucid dreams where I ask the dream version of him, help me find you. Like, where are you in the world? I need to find you. Mm. And I haven't been able to do it. But as soon as I put that intentionality out there and said, I'm committing to doing this, to finding him, right? Immediately. So yeah. Crazy.
That's amazing. I love that.
I don't even check. I don't even check to see. I mean, I assume it went to his other folder. I don't know because it's Facebook. I don't know if he read it or not, mm-hmm. But it's gone. You know, it's gone. That feeling of...
The debt.
The debt.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's paid.
That's so good. I mean, here's the thing too, I think I want people to hear is that closure is not something that you need other people to be part of.
Well, this is Dan Savage too.
Oh, is it?
Yes, he says closure is something you give yourself.
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. And it's just, it's a choice. And like, you can't wait around, because anytime you're like, I need my ex to have a conversation with me because I need closure. No, you need closure from you, and you need to leave your ex alone. Because most people aren't growing. I'll say this, like, on this, but it's sad, but true. If everyone was growing, we would literally solve all the problems that we have as a society. But the problem is too many people aren't growing. So like, those people who you like want to get validation from or whatever, they're not going to be available for that. And you need to be available for it. You need to be available for your growth and write your letters that you maybe never send to the people you feel like owe a debt to you, or that you owe a debt to, that it would be, because you know, in 12-step stuff, they say like, make an amends except where to do so, it would cause harm. Right? So, and some people you can't apologize to because it would cause harm, but you can apologize in yourself. You can create that closure and work on that stuff, potentially with an anti-racism coach to wrap it all into what you're doing and the service you're providing.
It's so funny. Yeah, that's it. And this concept of, I call it mutual accountability, but what happens is when white people are early on in their process, they solely look to people of color for validation. Yeah. And then as they get a little further in their process, they like never want to do it. Mm-hmm. And that's often the people that I get that I'm like, no, it is literally okay to ask the marginalized people in your life, like, hey, I want to be a great friend to you. How am I doing? Like, that's okay. Like, Bevan, like, what would it look like if a man in your life came to you and said, you know, I'm sorry it took me so long, but the Me Too movement has really woken me up. I really am committed to being a great feminist. I want to do a better job. Is there a time when you feel that I have acted out of sexism and I've caused harm to you? I want to take accountability for that. I want to make it right if I can.
Wow.
Would you be like, how dare you make me do that emotional labor for you?
No, I would not.
And has a man ever done that to you?
No, but I also will say that only recently have I developed friendships with straight men. And so I have a very well-curated amount of feminist straight men in my life who give a shit about being men of character.
Totally.
So, like, that's who I roll with.
I often say, like, what if your brother or your dad?
Okay. Brother or
dad. Or male boss came to you and said, like, I want to do better.
Yeah.
I want to take accountability. I want to learn. I want to grow.
Yeah.
And we do, you know, we do often get so fragile and we get so like, oh, well, I don't want to put someone in that position of having to educate me. Okay, that's great. Of course not. Don't use someone as a Google machine. Yeah. But like, also you have to build in accountability. You have to be able to name there's a difference between us. And I want to make sure it doesn't get in the way of our friendship. By being accountable to you, I want you to know I'm open to hearing you.
Oh my God, so good. Oh, that's so juicy. Ugh.
And then you're going to listen, and then you're going to believe them, and you're not going to get defensive, and you're going to be grateful for the learning that's there, and you're going to receive their feedback with wisdom to be able to discern when it's colored by their stuff and when you really did overstep.
And you're going to respect their boundaries if they do say, that's too much emotional labor for me. I don't feel like digging that up, and I'm glad you're doing this work. Peace and riches blessings.
You know,
and that's okay too. And also it's our work as people who've experienced oppression to decide if we want to open our boundaries enough to tell people about that. Cause like, honestly, most of the stuff I've experienced, fat phobia, you know, sexism, homophobia, all those things, I've pretty much handled that stuff. You know what I mean? Like, I don't really need to dig in. And, but yeah, like, anyway, I want to get to, before we have to wrap, I want to get to just your experience as a gestational parent, or however you want to term that, and like what that was like, and like maybe what you wish you had known before you transitioned, considering being a gestational pregnant person, because I don't even know what the mechanics of getting pregnant are as a person who's transitioned.
Well, when two people love each other very much. I'm just kidding.
I know three people can have a baby, Tristan.
Okay, well, that's how we did it. So there's no mechanics there. No, I mean, it is, you know, it's complicated for many people, less complicated for others. I just stopped taking my testosterone, regained my ovulatory cycle. My partner and I did the same thing we'd been doing before, but I was off testosterone. I got pregnant. I had a baby. Bada bing, bada boom.
Oh, wow. So your partner was able to impregnate you.
Yeah.
Oh, wow. Okay. I didn't know. I never know who's trans or not.
I know. That's so funny. My partner always is so flattered when people assume that they're a trans guy. Okay. They're like, that means I haven't said anything so offensive that I have outed myself as not a trans guy. Yeah. But yeah, my partner's body makes sperm. I have eggs and a uterus. It was just the easiest way. We've adopted two older kids and we wanted to grow our family and we couldn't do another adoption. And so it was just the easiest, cheapest way for us to do it. And then I ended up telling my story publicly, which became its whole other thing. So yeah.
Tell me about going viral about your story of becoming pregnant.
Yeah. Sorry, I'm just running a few minutes late.
Thanks, Kristen. I can't believe this conversation has gone so fast.
I know, I'm so sorry.
Oh, I don't apologize. This is
3 o'clock thing. I mean, it was not expected. I did plan to tell our story publicly. It was when, you know, it was during the time when Janet Mock and Laverne Cox and other trans women of color, you know, were constantly being put in this position to both answer invasive questions about themselves and their bodies and trans people, and also do the labor of explaining why those invasive questions were inappropriate. And, you know, as a trans guy, it's like for so many years, my job was if I got handed a microphone, I handed that microphone off to a trans woman. Like that was my job. We didn't want or need to be in the spotlight. There were more marginalized people that were more personally and directly impacted by transphobia than we were. And so we got into this moment where it kind of flipped, where it just started to feel immoral to let trans women of color do all the work of trans education on this public scale. It just felt so gross watching them do that like emotional pretzeling of like tying yourself in a knot to make cisgender people happy while also trying to leave them better than you found them. Mm-hmm. And I thought, you know, because I'm white, because I live in Portland, because unless I'm pregnant and in the news, I'm not someone who is read as being trans, given all those privileges, it seemed really appropriate that I tell my story publicly, and because I would be better able to take some of the backlash than people who are more marginalized. And to try to take some of the burden off of the shoulders of trans women of color to tell a trans story that was a positive one, like Janet Mock, like Laverne Cox, they're like out there doing the most. Mm-hmm. And to kind of use the pregnant man headline as like a hook. Mm-hmm. To get in that door to start to tell the story about our family and love, family love, romantic love, community love, all those things I thought I was saying no to when I came out as trans in whatever 2000, to be able to shift that narrative a little bit. And I just didn't know it was going to blow up the way that it did.
I mean,
but it did.
It did. I'm curious if you can just share, did you have top surgery before you got pregnant?
I did not, no.
Oh, you didn't. Okay. So you were able to breastfeed?
I may have been physically able, but I chose not to.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. That's not something that I wanted to do.
Yeah. I was just curious because like, I feel like some people, I mean, now that we know what's possible, right, for people and bodies and transition and like maybe one day gestationally carrying, like I'm curious about like advice you would give to like a young trans person who hasn't made any body modifications, if there's anything they can do to like,
I mean, it depends on how old they are. If they're post-pubescent, mm-hmm. I mean, advice is so complicated, but people can definitely preserve their fertility. And all the data that we have, and now there are lots of studies, academic, medically rigorous, scientifically rigorous studies that show that testosterone does not impact egg quality or quantity. Oh. So as long as you are happy going off of testosterone and harvesting your eggs or getting pregnant yourself, you don't have to preserve your fertility before you transition. But a lot of people don't want to do that. They don't want to go off of their hormones, get their period back, get pregnant or have an invasive procedure to harvest their eggs. So, you know, a lot of more people every day are doing fertility preservation ahead of time. The top surgery question, it's really a matter of choice. You know, it depends on how dysphoric you are about your chest. And you just have to weigh your decisions like everything else. I don't belong to the cult of breastfeeding. I don't think that human milk is the magical cure to all things that have ever ailed humans ever. I understand that people think that it's free. It's only free if you don't value the time of the breastfeeding person. I understand that people think that it's easy. That's not true. Over 10% of people who aren't otherwise trans or anything are not physically able to produce enough milk for their babies. And we get stuck into a transphobic, anti-feminist shame spiral about what our bodies are meant to do or not meant to do, about what's natural and what's unnatural. And that shame, the like, you know, the sort of like breastfeeding movement is having, because I work with hundreds of trans people all over the world, it's having a deleterious effect. I've never used that word before, but it's having a profoundly negative effect on trans people because they're feeling guilted and shamed into using their bodies in a way that they don't want to. Some trans people do want to chest feed, and that's great. Some don't or can't, or it's causing them severe distress, or they had top surgery because they couldn't live anymore with that body. Yeah. And people are making them feel really, really horrific, and they're having to choose between their mental health and feeding their baby. When I'm like, okay, there are so many other perfectly, like 100% equal options, especially when you factor in the mental health of the birthing person, that are like just as good, just as healthy, just as safe. So, you know, yeah.
Yes, I love that. So Tristan, how can people find you? How can people find your webinar? Because you teach about this. There's hours of this content available because there's a webinar now. How do people find this? How do people book you for anti-racism coaching and or
consulting? Yeah. I mean, my website is collaborate.consulting. That's my website. And then personally online on Instagram and Facebook, I'm Biff and I. My partner's name is Biff. And so we're just Biff and I. And so you can see baby pictures there. I love him so much, his little face. I posted today him playing with his My Little Pony dolls. And I'm like, me, like queer me at 18 would just be like so mortified that I had kids at all, but would be like overjoyed that I had like a 3-year-old boy toddler who like loves My Little Pony.
Good.
Yeah, but I really appreciate you connecting with me.
You're a miracle. More soon, please. I cannot believe how swiftly this hour and 11 minutes went. Thank you so much for hanging in there, telling your story and sharing with all of us. And I just appreciate you so much, Kristen. Thank you.
Thank you.
So that's the show. I hope you enjoyed my conversation with Tristan. I hope you leave feeling inspired to get out of your own way, drop some of your insecurities by just getting a little bit better every day. Imagine this, a year from now, you've gotten 1% better every day, kept showing up for yourself. What could change? What could your life look like? But I want you to know, no matter what, that exactly as you are right now, you are worthy of love. There is nothing you need to change in order to be worthy of love. You are valuable. Your value comes from just being here and existing. And I am just so proud of you for being here. Thanks for tuning in, and I'll see you next week.